This is the Limitless, the podcast between. You're listening to Jason Horsley talking to the original podcast partner from the days of stormy weather, Kerry McCoy, including musical intervals by Kerry McCoy. Now I realised, just because I've just done a podcast with Dave O'Shaughnessy, and so I was kind of excited about it, and made me think back on podcasting, and I realised it was 10 years exactly since, give or take a month, since we did that first Stormy Weather.
Wow.
Yeah.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
Where were you living at the time? 10 years ago when we chatted for the first time.
Yeah, well, I suppose it was the first time we spoke, because we'd been corresponding for a few years, but I was in London by that point.
Okay, yeah, and I was living up in Fort Worth.
Yeah, and I don't remember the genesis of it, really, except I just thought, oh, I'll do a radio show, and, oh, I should do it with someone, not just me, and, oh, I'll do it with Kerry. And
better than nothing.
Uh-huh. Do you remember anything about it?
I just remember getting pretty animated and excitable about talking about, you know, my paranormal cult experiences with someone.
Yeah. And didn't you have an experience listening back of being a bit chagrined? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, just kind of probably having second thoughts about being so open, so honest and sincere, you know. Mostly, I think, are looking back on it now, I don't enjoy how excited I get. Because I don't know if you've ever noticed, but important, thoughtful, deep thinkers, they stop and pause a lot when they speak. And they keep a very low, even vocal register.
There are exceptions. I mean, there's this Zizek. You know about Zizek?
No.
Okay, well, I'll send you a clip of Zizek after we're done to show their exceptions. He's a very hyperactive speaker, and he's snuffling and he's doing all these tics, and you might find it unpleasant or annoying. A lot of people do, but he's certainly excited, but he's certainly thinking deeply. So,
right, well, you know, there are two different types of sort of excitability. Whenever I watch people, there's the childlike, I'm so excited, I just can't get it all out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like a kid, how a kid rambles. That's how I was rambling. And then there's the other kind, which we see more of today, which is sort of the angry diatribe, you know, that usually goes along with like politics and stuff.
The pundit, the Jeff Beck kind of thing. Yeah, so that first kind doesn't sound bad at all.
It sounds silly, though, after you listen back and you realize you're a grown man and you sound like a... an 8-year-old boy who's just sucked down a couple of soda pops and you're, you know, so high strung.
Yeah, maybe to you. I mean, I don't think it does or did to others. But I was also thinking that maybe I put your own style or intonations or whatever we're going to call it in stark relief, because I tend to be so much the other way.
Right.
But I think that would have made for, I mean, that probably was part of what made it you a good talking partner, right from the get-go, those different qualities, I think.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. They are fun to listen to.
One of the things I wonder about with you, because we don't stay in touch a lot, we get in touch at regular intervals, but we often just talk about new stuff, is how much your point of view about occult stuff and the things we talked about then, how much it's changed and how much is still the same from back then.
The more things change, the more they stay the same, huh?
Well, I don't know. Is that true or isn't it?
'Cause it is. Yeah. It is true.
So they have changed, but at the same time, something has stayed the same.
Yeah. You know, it's the same sort of basic narrative, but new characters coming in and playing the roles. New backdrop, mm-hmm. a new set, new characters, different costumes, different accents. The audience moves over, sits on the other side of the auditorium. They change the lighting, and then they do the same play.
Right.
it's the same. You know, whenever you're younger, when I was younger, a lot of these sayings didn't really, you know, like really register at a true visceral level. Like, you know, ignorance is bliss. Hmm. When you say that to a kid, they're like, they really can't understand that. You know what I mean? Hmm. You have to get a little older and become burdened with the knowledge of what a corrupt, you know, you just sort of have to accumulate the knowledge of what you don't really want to know. It just kind of leaks into your, you know, all that's going to leak into your worldview sooner or later. You know, you're going to find out what parents typically try to shield their children from. You know, you're going to figure out what the hamburger is actually made out of, and
right,
you know, all this great stuff. And so kids really can't understand that ignorance is bliss, you know.
Right. And same with the change.
Yeah. Yeah, the older you get, the more you get to see the set change. You know, when you get into your 50s, you know, or like your late 40s, I think it's when you start going, really, we're doing this again? You know, when I was a kid, it was the Ayatollah Khomeini and, you know, and it was Bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, Kim Jong-un, Vladimir Putin. Here we go again. You know, it's just the same old, same old.
Well, that's the world stage, but you're also talking about your internal landscape, sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, your internal landscape is kind of a microcosm of the world, right? I mean, it's just your perception of how things change around you.
Well, my experience is it's the same, but it's also different. Like I have the experience you're talking about, which sounds, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds a bit will weary and a bit jaded, a bit cynical. Like you say, it's the same old play, just different actors, just a remake of the same old movie that wasn't that good in the first time. You know, as it sort of has that flavor to it. And I certainly have that experience, certainly looking out at the world, I do, but I also have it sometimes looking at myself. But there's another experience I have, which is the opposite, even though it's kind of similar. I mean, even though it fits that cliche, the more things change, which is that I leave behind, like specifically talking about the occult and that, like, as you're probably pretty well familiar, even if you haven't been following anything I've been doing when we're not talking, that I've really distanced myself from a whole lot of that stuff in the years, to the point that I'm embarrassed about Homo sapiens. I even started rewriting Homo sapiens like as an apology, like I was going to just apologize and correct. And I didn't actually finish it because whatever, something else came along. But that's how strongly I feel about those concepts and beliefs that I was so invested in. And, you know, back when we met and when we were doing Stormy Weather, that was, you know, you did the cover for Homo sapiens, and so you were right there with me during the Aeolus Genesis period. And as I say, like 99% of those concepts and those beliefs have been revealed to me as delusional, in quotes, as in sort of compensatory fancy, but never like completely and categorically, just like, well, I don't know if they're true or not. All I know is that I was drawn to them and I kind of turned them into narratives because of deficiencies in myself, so I can't really trust, you know, my judgment about that. So I left it open. And then in the ensuing years, like to today, it's as though a lot of that stuff does seem, maybe it was true, maybe I was right, but I had to let go of the concepts in order to have a more direct experience of what it was that I had the concepts about.
We know one of the things, or one of the reasons, I guess, why it's been harder for me to follow you is because you take such a hard line, sort of tunnel vision approach to everything. I mean, you go like 100% all in on everything, which makes for a great writer because you completely immerse yourself in whatever it is you're doing, like the John DeRuiter fiasco.
We can call it that
Right.
experiment if we're going to be more charitable, yeah.
Yeah. But see, even with our approach, I guess, to awareness, we're kind of like opposites too. We're complementary because you take the tunnel vision, you have like this laser that you point sort of at everything and hyper analyze it. And I have like this broad spectrum, maybe this, maybe that, I don't know.
Right.
Could be this, could be that, could be, I don't really know. I know that, I mean, it's hard to really describe my sort of like my occult awareness. Like at this point is just basically all I can really say for certain is just that this reality and whatever it is we're immersed in is sort of an artificial layer. And it's real, but it, like I've said before, I've used the analogy that it's like real, like the zoo. Like one monkey looks around and he says, all of this is artificial. It's not real. It's an artificial construct where, it's completely artificial. And the other monkey knocks on the bars and says, that's as real as it gets. Right? So neither one of them are really wrong. That's kind of my perception now, is that it's completely real. I'm immersed in it. It's as real as it gets, but there's something about it, and I know that there's something under the surface. It's like this, there's something behind the scenes. There's like a greater control system. You can call it whatever you want. I hate calling putting words attached to it because, I mean, it could be like something creepy sci-fi kind of thing, It could be like literally like we're just an experiment from like some super alien race, that orbits on the other side of the sun and just, and we're just like a little, like a petri dish, literally. You know what I mean? I mean, it could be something more organic and natural. I had this theory a while back that artificial intelligence has actually already, was actually fully developed, like billions. I mean, who even knows who, or would be pointless to try to put a time frame on it, but artificial intelligence is just kind of recreating sub-realities the same way a gardener like cross-pollinates flowers and looks for new species. And it just keeps trying to go back and find its, and like sort of recreate its original inception. And then in the process it like creates multiple variants of itself. Who knows, like thousands, millions, all the time. It's just constantly recreating its origin. You know what I mean? Like, and it tries to, I don't know, it's just like trying to discover itself again.
Right, so but why artificial? Like if that's the origin of what we are and of
Well,
everything.
that's a good point. Yeah, why even call it artificial? Yeah. No, but it would be like, I guess, something like what we would consider today, like our current sort of nomenclature perception would be what today we're calling artificial intelligence. But it doesn't necessarily, I mean, because you could say a tree is artificial, depending on who originally made it. I mean, who made nature? Nature could be artificial, often
Yeah,
thought
if
that
it
it could.
was created,
Yeah.
but it's definitely in comparison to what or in relation to what.
Right. So that word doesn't really even mean anything. It's just kind of a
Well, it might, but it's a question of defining it, isn't it? Like,
Yeah, totally. I mean, it could mean whatever you want it to mean, and a tree could be artificial.
yeah, or artificial, or a machine could be natural if it's an extension of. And this is actually interesting enough. This is a few threads are intertwining now very quickly because I'm just looking over material that I wrote during when horticulture was, created the website and all that, and I wrote a whole series on autism. And this intersects the point you just made about my tunnel vision, which is looking back at that, I'm like, God, I really thought autism was it back then, and I was just totally committed to that. And now it just seems like a sort of a deviation on my path, and I kind of abandoned that whole project. Why did I abandon it? Oh, it's because of this, because of what you just said, that because I thought it was the whole thing I'd found suddenly, when I realized it wasn't the whole thing, I thought, it's nothing, right? Rather than no, it's just one more iteration on my journey. Consciousness is just finding different metaphors to experience itself, and autism was one for a while. And then, anyway, the second point being that after that, or as a continuation of that, I started looking at Philip K. Dick and this whole question of the relationship between consciousness and technology, and how that relates to autism, as in the theories about autism's been increased by all the technology, but also autists are able to use technology to communicate with, right? If they're non-verbal and so on. So the same this area I was looking at, which was became fascinating to me, I also kind of semi-abandoned it, was what we're touching on here, like to what extent would artificial intelligence, if it came about, not really be artificial because it would come about through technology that we had created using our consciousness to create it. So it would really just be extensions of ourselves in the same way that a tree is an extension of nature, which is an extension of whatever the hell nature comes out of it.
Exactly.
So
But
one of
what
the,
if the, like if somebody takes some seeds to another continent where a plant or something has never existed, and he just Johnny Appleseed, just kind of throws the seeds and it starts to grow on another continent where it's never existed before, right? So that tree doesn't belong there. And then again, we have to look at the word belong in quotes,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. Because Johnny Appleseed is part of nature too.
Right. He took it there. It wouldn't be there if it weren't for Johnny Appleseed, right? It's kind of out of place. You could say it's artificial, sort of,
Well, it's human intervention. I mean, that seems to be our definition of artificial, is something that humans have done, which was probably part of the belief that humans are somehow above nature or, special or unique in nature.
Yeah, and then you start picking it apart and you start looking at intervention. What does that mean? How is that intervening in something,
Which kind of intervention? Because there's a few kinds there, aren't there?
Right. I think it's
Like,
very, very blurry.
I mean, there's divine intervention is the obvious one.
Right.
Then there's intervention that families do when their children are addicted to drugs. There's that kind at the other end of the spectrum.
Right.
Which is Johnny Appleseed, though? Is that what you're referring to, the kind of sort of industrial human enterprise intervention?
Sure.
Which is like.
Then, of course, I'm using it as an analogy for divine intervention, I mean,
Yes.
if we were seeded, and sort of allowed to progress and evolve with a little clipping and trimming and fertilization here and there where needed, kind of mold and shape a little bit, just like you would a shrub out front.
Yeah, if we were, then. I mean, what is this good for besides an intellectual exercise? That's what I'm wondering.
I don't know. I'm thinking an intellectual exercise is just what is anything good for? other than an intellectual exercise.
Well, as you know, there's lots of people who do believe in the alien intervention theory and the ancient astronauts and all that, and not necessarily people we'd want to be having a conversation with, right? And then there's lots of people who believe that in divine intervention that we're created by God or the gods or the Elohim and stuff. I'd be more in that camp, but I wouldn't necessarily want to talk with those people either. I mean, not that I would, refuse to,
Right.
but you know what I mean, like.
Yeah.
That the belief that people have adopted around that serves some purpose for them, and I'm not necessarily in support of that purpose.
Right.
So, but I think it is a. I mean, obviously it's a meaningful question, because if you want to know yourself, you want to know where you came from and why, if there was a purpose, and how you were made. What you're made of, and this is what we'd be getting at.
That word, the purpose, they're looking for a purpose, that's one of the things where I've kind of I don't know, what's the word here? I've really come to have more of a concrete viewpoint on purpose and belief. I don't really like labels and terms, but I would go ahead and say that I'm a full-on agnostic, and that my point of view is pretty incompatible with atheists or religious people. In fact, I consider atheism a religion, and it kind of comes back to purpose. They all have to know the purpose and the reason, and they all have a distilled, quantified version of events in reality that gives their life the purpose they need. And really what it does is it just takes away ambiguity and not knowing and uncertainty, because those people can't live with uncertainty. They can't live with not knowing. For them, in order for their lives to have purpose, they have to have knowing. Doesn't it seem like that the two go hand in hand with people like this?
I think that that was very close to the point I was making about there's people who have these beliefs because those beliefs serve a purpose for them.
Right.
They give meaning.
Meaning.
They give a context that makes their lives feel more meaningful and special, perhaps.
Right.
And that doesn't seem the purpose of beliefs of that kind or of inquiries of that kind. To me, the purpose would be, like, if there's any purpose we have, I'd say it's to find out what our purpose is at this point. Right? At least let's, I mean, you could say, well, your position as an agnostic, maybe you will say, is you don't care what your purpose is.
But
that's
what
fine.
If, like a long time ago, in that weird little voice or the entity told me that to repress the threshold of knowledge. Oh, wait, shoot. Yeah. Okay, I remember. Oh, well. I can't remember it. Anyway.
Paraphrase, yeah.
Knowing the end. Don't you think that takes away from the exploration? The end's coming. We don't know. They already know the narrative. They already know the story. So how are they going to explore themselves?
Well, yes, but that was my point.
Yeah. I think we're both saying the same thing.
But do you think that it's worthwhile exploring our existence here, partly to discover our individual purpose? As you as Carey, me as Jason. Like, I do feel I have a purpose in this life. I have a reason for being here. Absolutely. I don't necessarily believe that I need to know it in order to fulfill it. I think that's a very interesting liminal area, because I think thinking you know it will definitely prevent you from fulfilling it if you're wrong. But even possibly knowing you that you know it and being right might get in the way of fulfilling it.
Possibly. I don't know.
I mean, isn't that what the thing said to you? Something, wasn't it something to do with that, about the threshold of knowledge?
It said to disambiguate is to repress the threshold of knowledge. That was exactly what it said.
Right. See, it's a very liminalist statement that entity gave you, because it has the word threshold, which is where liminal comes from, and it has the word, disambiguate. He made that word up, whoever it was, because I don't think you'll find it in the dictionary, but...
Really?
Well, you could try.
Let me look it up.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't in all this time.
I probably did. I don't know. I'm pretty bad about not looking words up and just assuming what they mean, and sometimes how to pronounce it. It's got me in trouble.
Well, if it's not, you need to patent it real quick.
Yeah, I know that's a word, because even on Wikipedia, it has there's a disambiguation.
Really? Sort of. Yeah. Well, how many times have you heard it? I mean, you would have gone looking for it, but if you hadn't...
The first time I heard it, I didn't know what it meant. I was just writing it down, you know, but...
Yeah, well, I didn't ask you what it meant, because I can obviously work out what it means.
Yeah, I mean, I did too. I didn't really need to look it up.
Right. So you know what Freud said about neurosis is the inability to tolerate ambiguity.
No. What did Freud say about that?
Just that. Just what I quoted.
So, say it again, because that's a lot to wrap your head around.
That neurosis is the inability to tolerate ambiguity.
Oh.
So you could even say the root of neurosis is disambiguation.
Yeah. Well, that's what the concrete belief system people... They're all neurotics. That sounds about right.
Yeah, but then who isn't neurotic? So it's kind of it's a spectrum, right?
Me, no.
It's a spectrum, and
me and my supreme belief system.
So, well, juxtapose. I mean, I know you're being ironic, but with a purpose. And again, if you juxtapose you and I, but based on your definition of what your description from earlier, and even I would say, you know, other people's impression and even my experience, I would seem in many ways like a believer, in that I do go all out for something. I totally believed in John DeRuyter. I totally believed in autism. I totally believed in it. Well, I don't know. I was just say alien abduction, but that one doesn't really fit. I totally believed in Castaneda and so on, right?
Right.
But There was something going on where I was never really all in, wouldn't you say?
Would I say that there was something that you weren't ever really all aboard on?
Yeah, whatever it was. It seems like there was always something that knew that I was trying something on.
I don't really know what you mean. Like an outside intelligence was like,
or an inside one, that there was
something.
There was a set, I think, because of all the beliefs that I took on, central to all of them was this thing that you're saying, that you know that there's something artificial about the environment we're in, back to that word again, but there's something missing. It's just a partial representation of reality, and therefore it's a misrepresentation if we take it for the whole thing. So there was always that sense in all those different beliefs, and that was sort of self-contradicting, because if I'm saying that this belief system includes the belief that me and my ego mind can't actually cognate reality, then it had to include this particular belief system. As in, I'm just using this as a map, just to see how well it helps me navigate the territory as compared to, you know, what I was conditioned and raised to believe. It's like I kept trying out different things as a way to kind of shake loose my conditioning, I think.
I kind of get you. You mean like it's sort of like just a way to recontextualize your awareness, huh?
Yeah. And my experience, in fact. Yeah.
Yeah, I see it. So but you like fully, but you always like, you know, you're like a method actor in that way, is that you really fully immerse yourself in it. You know, you had to like, you know, 100% get into the character and block everything else out in order to determine whether it was something you wanted to embrace or reject.
Or to see if it was going to work, even.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Because there's a real paradox in this, which is that if in order to for this belief system to work, as in to shake loose, you know, our preconceptions about reality and just see that they're just preconceptions, we have to completely believe this new belief system, but we have to know that we're doing it to do that, if you see what I mean. We know that we're pretending to believe something, but we have to do it so well that we forget that we're pretending to believe it. It's a bit like going into a movie, you know. You say, I paid for this movie. I really want to immerse myself in it, see what it's like to be these other characters, have the full experience, and then only when it's over will I remember that I was in a movie.
Yeah. Right.
So, I mean, I think I'm just winging it here, of course, but I think that that might be a facsimile of this higher intelligence that you're positing, that creates these iterations of itself in order to have an experience of some kind. I'm not sure. That's as far as I can take it, because you were
positive. Yeah,
does that make sense?
Sure. We're all little tentacles, huh? Little tentacles of the giant hive mind losing its tiny little fraction of awareness and immersing that tiny fraction of awareness into its own little sort of red light district artificial world, and sucking the information back in and growing its awareness of the possible realms of experience.
So that's a purpose in that, then. It's not just escapism.
Well, it's both. I mean, yeah, sure, because it could just sit there and be at one with itself and its, you know, perfect state of absence and just radiate perfect nothingness, or it can splinter off and create a psycho melodrama and bring back the information and go, huh, well, that's interesting. The little Jason, look at the little Jason node, what it's doing. It's trying to look past the one-way mirror, and he's talking with Carrie again, and Carrie keeps banging on the mirror trying to figure out what's going on. Right? Something like that. Yeah, it could get crazy if you think about it. Well, it is crazy. The whole thing is crazy.
It is crazy. I mean, this is the core. That's the splinter, to go back to another, you know, narrative that I fully invested in. That's the splinter in my brain that I've always been aware of, which I don't become less aware of as time goes on, which is just being here is completely impossible.
Oh, yeah, totally. In fact, I'm going to sound like an idiot for saying it, but there's that law in physics where what is it, law of perpetual motion, where everything's eventually going to atrophy and fall apart and slow down.
Yeah.
You know, well, why hasn't everything? Because, you know, if you go back, I mean, we've been, the whole thing's been here for infinity, you know, and then they got this Big Bang bullshit, right? Where, I mean, it just defies all laws of physics. The Big Bang does.
Yeah.
Where does all the energy come from to make all this happen and create all this matter? And why is it still moving? Why are any stars still burning? They should have burned out a long time ago.
Yeah, and how are you and I still here, even though, I mean, well, see, here it goes. It's like, we got this thing called language, which is this linear stream of associations that go from the beginning to the end of a sentence and so on. And then we've got this thing called time, in which language is able to, you know, extend itself, which has also supposedly got this beginning, a middle, and an end. I mean, if it's got a beginning and an end, it's got a middle. And if it didn't have a beginning and end, it wouldn't be time.
All right.
So yeah, I couldn't really finish that sentence. But it's like, how come we're here having this conversation when actually what we are an extension of began, you know, an eternity ago. Yeah, so should have ended an eternity ago also.
I like to, I really love to like sort of come up with analogies and recontextualize stuff to illustrate how ridiculous it is, because sometimes people just need a different visual, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So imagine if, you know, we finally went to Mars and we land on Mars and we go into a cave and there's like a bunch of candles burning, you know, and the scientists show up and go, oh man, these candles are really long burning candles. They burn halfway down, but apparently these candles last 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to be here for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to burn out in 1,000 years. They have a finite lifespan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody lit them.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, that's I'm I guess it's not that great. I don't know. But that's what I kind of see when I see stars, is I basically see candles burning in the sky.
Yeah, no, I think I get it. The basically, the scientists aren't able to think back more than 1,000 years, so they're just like, well, somebody lit them, they're still here, and they're going to be
Right,
here for
right.
a really long time. And isn't that great? There's life on Mars, or at least there was.
Yeah, anyways, I blew that whole thing. Yeah, it wasn't too great. But anyways, that's kind of what I look at when I look up into the night sky and I see all the stars. They look like candles that are burning, and they're all going to burn out.
Okay, I mean, to me, this does speak to our initial sort of departure point. This is about the concepts that they seem like they represent some occult aspects of reality, but when you really look at them, wait, they're just concepts that I came up with to deal with the endless abyss of being here.
Right.
They're sort of coping mechanisms, because what we're getting to now is that the reality that's outside the zoo and the cage, the one that the monkey feels in his body, one of them does and the other one doesn't, and they're having this conversation, one of them's saying there's something else out there, and the other one's going, no, you don't get it, this is all there is. Well, okay, in a certain sense, the second monkey's right, as you say, because they're never going to get out of that zoo. So yeah,
Right.
that really is all there is. But the first monkey's really more right, because even if they never get out, he knows in his body that actually he was once, in the jungle, or his ancestors are in the jungle, and that's actually his true environment, his true context. So that monkey's more right, even if he never gets out of the zoo. But on the other hand, the context that's outside the zoo that we're talking around now is infinite and eternal. Like, because anything else less than that is just another zoo outside the zoo, right? It's just another artifice, presumably. I mean, it's a question, really,
I
but.
don't know. My analogy with the zoo is more like of a physical, tangible place. Like it's artificial, and the other monkey says, no, it's real. So is the actual physical enclosure, the world they live in, the zoo itself, is it artificial or is it real? It's artificial because it's man-made, right? But it's real because that's all they have and that's where they live. It's real.
Yeah, well, but artificial and real, they're not opposites. I mean, I know you're using them that way, but whatever, this computer is real,
Right.
but it's also an artifice. So,
Well,
so
that's kind of the point I was making. It's like neither one of them is really wrong. It just depends on where you want to, what you want to see and how you want to see it.
what isn't real, though, in this sense, isn't it to do with, does it represent who I am?
No, really the point is reality is completely subjective. You project reality out onto.
Yeah, but surely the monkey, I'm going to reiterate my point, that the monkey who says this zoo isn't real, or at least it's not natural, I'd rather use that word because it's a bit more qualified, is more right than the monkey who says it is. Because that monkey knows that there is something beyond the zoo, and the other monkey doesn't.
Okay, we can split hairs on this all day, but yeah, more or less, yeah.
You're agreeing, because I think you identify with the monkey who says, hey, wait, the zoo isn't it, man.
Yeah, I'm the monkey that says it's not real, but the monkey who says it is real, I'm like, yeah, you're right, it is real. I mean, we're stuck here.
But that's not the same thing. I mean, that's kind of the crux as well, isn't it? Like, are we stuck here, or is the A, is there a way out, and B, do we want to take it if there is?
Yeah, that's the real, now we're getting to the real question, huh? What is out there? I mean, what are we trying to get away from? In fact, that's come up before.
Before what?
When I started that little secret or the little Facebook discussion forum, what I called it, false, or yeah,
Monkey
it was the
simulation.
lit fault. Wait, flesh ape. Yeah, flesh ape liberation simulation exercise.
All right, there you
Right.
go.
That's right, false. Flesh ape liberation simulation exercise.
Oh, I see. It's an acronym. Good one. I don't think I spotted the acronym. Right. Well, it was on Facebook, so.
Right. But yeah, that's it. I mean, do you want to get away from something, or are we trying to? He's talking about purpose. You have a purpose. You think you're gonna get to graduate and move on to a different astral realm or something when you realize your purpose and fulfill it. Something to that effect. If we're just gonna be, you know, new agey and just kind of throw it out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't necessarily have to jump all the way there. I mean, first off, let's stay on the trying to get away from something. Is it necessarily that, or is it because the monkey isn't trying to get out away from the zoo? He's trying to get back to nature. But in order to do so, he's got to get out of the zoo. All right, and there isn't anything really grandiose or epic about that. It's just his nature is calling to him, and the jungle's calling to him, and there's just this mutual yearning.
Right. Yeah, no, but I mean, what if the jungle's gone? I mean, like, I know it's kind of a silly point to bring up because, you know, we're trying to be philosophical, but I mean,
it's out that.
You know, if a monkey finally gets out of the zoo and he finds himself in downtown L.A., major metropolitan area, what's the next thing he needs to do is figure out how to cross the Atlantic Ocean and get back home, right?
Yeah. It's not going to be an easy journey for that monkey. He's got to really believe. He's got to really be able to feel the call of the jungle, assuming it is still there. Because I mean, actually, your point was a good one. I mean, at what point is there no more jungle for the monkey to get back to, and does the monkey still feel the yearning then? Because I mean, that as a metaphor, we're not far from that as a species.
Yeah, I think it's kind of something like that too, similar. I'm not really sure.
So, I mean, it does beg the question, like, you know, we know that survival's a purpose. We have a purpose to survive. We have an instinct to survive, and that is a purpose. Like, you and I, we're both driven by that purpose. We get up in the morning, as you said once, because your bladder makes you, and then we make breakfast, and we clean, and we do all the stuff that basically to maintain our existence physically. So we know that part. So then we also know that if there were circumstances, let's say in our town or in our house even, that were threatening our survival, we would then have a higher purpose to change those circumstances in order to, you know, not to get destroyed further on down the line. So even there you got, even just the survival instinct could give us, you know, a purpose beyond just surviving day to day, as in we got to think about the larger picture.
Right.
And then beyond that, I mean, it does leave a question mark, like, I mean, if you think that we're programmed to survive, or whatever you're going to call it, I don't like to use the word programmed, actually, because it makes it sound like machines, but if we're, you know, we're given the innate instinct to survive, and if we stay with this model that you're introducing, that there's some sort of creation behind our existence, is not purely random. Why were we programmed to survive? I mean, why were we built to survive?
Because we're building something, right?
So we're building something beyond ourselves, you mean?
Right, yeah.
So then that would be a purpose then, that we have an innate purpose beyond our own survival, but we need to survive in order to fulfill that purpose.
Yeah, I think so. I think that you could say that's, what's the heart's purpose? Why does the heart beat 24/7, you know? The heart beats.
Mm-hmm.
What's in it for the heart? You know, a nice, warm, squishy place to live.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's a bit circular, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's working together with the whole body.
Well, that's kind of sometimes I think that's what humanity is. I mean, you know, you've heard like the transhumanist movement, you know, we're building the network. The network is sort of the central nervous system of the earth, and you know, we're the cells creating this big, you know, being.
Yeah, I have heard that. And then the goal of which is to go into space and spread the transhumanist religion further, further and further afield.
Well, by that point, the term transhumanist will be an anachronism, and it won't even be considered transhumanist anymore, because that, like saying a baby saying that we're going to go spread, you know, the second trimesterist or something, you know, or we're going to go, you know, like an embryo.
Like
We're an
2001.
embryo. We're growing, you know. But it's sort of a egocentric perspective, sort of, you know, that we have of ourselves right now. You know.
So is it? Because it seemed, I mean, you went straight to transhumanism as if it was compatible with what I was talking about, but it seems as though it's almost like a mirror image of it, isn't it? Or like a shadow of it.
What were you talking about exactly? That
The idea that we
you're
have a purpose that was built into us by whatever intelligence, in quotes, whatever.
Oh, yeah, like an individual purpose.
Collective and individually,
Yeah, no, it's I hear that that's sort of kind of the that actually gets brought up in politics is sort of like the main split in political ideology, you know, whether it's the individual that serves the state or, you know, is the state there to serve the individual, right? Yeah, and so it kind of manifests itself there, right?
But there's so that's back to the counterfeit, isn't it? Because it could be the individual and the collective would be the collective humanity. But where does the state come into that? Like the state's like a stake through the heart of the collective.
No, you're right. Yeah, it is.
And yet it was created by humans, apparently.
Right. Yep, interesting conundrum.
It is a conundrum because we don't, I mean, human beings are definitely purpose driven, but they seem to be very deluded about their sense of purpose. As in, I mean, all of the problems that we have as a species seem to be the result of humans having a really strong sense of purpose. As in, you know, they want to build bridges, they want to build bombs, they want to, you know, conquer nations, they want to spread religion, whatever it is. But it's all, none of this would have happened if humans weren't really inspired to do shit. Because well, I'll be specific, like, because I sent you the piece on Dave O'Shaughnessy a couple of weeks ago, not because I thought we would talk about it, but just because it was what I was working on at the time, so it would give you know, an update of where I was at. And you know, Dave is very, I'd say he's very purpose driven. I'd say he has a mission. And he thinks that, you know, we all have missions and he wants to help us find our missions and so on and so forth. And at certain points in his presentation, let's say, he speaks about the mission in very grandiose terms, as in recently he was talking about how where we're at now in terms of the technology, the society, that humans are becoming less and less embodied, they're becoming more and more spliced with the technology and more dissociated from their just lived reality, that the species is running out of time and that within a generation or so nobody's going to be able to get enlightened because they're not in tune with their bodies anymore. So there's just no way to connect to the transmission or the life force anyway, and that they're, you know, therefore we need to concentrate our efforts and save humanity. Now, I'm really, really skeptical of that kind of talk, even if it's true. Because of this thing I'm saying, that it just seems to me that all the shit that we've done as human beings seems to have been driven by a sense of a higher purpose. So sometimes it seems that maybe it's better just to be agnostic, as you put it, and just be content to just bumble along. But that doesn't seem like the answer either. So yeah, I'm a bit divided about this.
Yep, I don't know.
What do you feel like? Because you're somebody who, how do we put it? I mean, you say you're an agnostic, but you're not an agnostic. I mean, agnostic just really means ignorant. you're not blissfully ignorant.
But see, that's an interesting, you know, word to bring up, because I like that old saying that says, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know.
Yeah.
But that's why I always liked the term, I'm an agnostic Gnostic. Because Gnostic means knowing, agnostic means not knowing. So it seems like a contradiction in terms, but it's not, because the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. In fact, the most ignorant people who really don't know anything are the most confident people and are very sure of what they know. The more you know, the more you don't know.
I mean, yes, I agree with the principle. It's not always the case in specifics. Like, there are people who are ignorant and know nothing, and they're not confident. You know, they're just train wrecks of human beings staggering around.
Possibly.
There are those types. So I think
I guess, because in what you were saying, I mean, I'm an information sponge. I absorb information. I'm into everything. You know, I follow everything, and I've always been that way. I'm just insatiable, have an insatiable curiosity about everything, and I really don't have a, I guess, filter, and I don't have a political or religious orientation. I just look at everything and see what I see, you know. You can ask me what I think about something, because I can tell you, but it's just, you know, also, I also believe that my opinion, like my father used to say, opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one, and they all stink. The older I get, the more I realize that's true.
Did he get that from Dirty Harry, or did Dirty Harry probably get it from him?
He probably did. Did Dirty Harry say that?
Yeah, he didn't add the bit about stinking. I said that. I had that at my website, weirdly enough.
I said that probably in one of our first talks, you know. My father used to say that all the time.
Wow.
Opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one, and they all stink. It's true.
But are there things that you say and think that you don't consider to be opinions?
No. I don't know. Maybe there's some specific things that I think are total facts, but honestly, I feel like the best I can do is give you my sincere viewpoint, my best guess, my best analysis of something at any given time, and it could change at any moment, you know?
You mean change radically, or just change?
Sure, with any kind of new information, it could just completely change.
Well, what about... Well, no, you didn't want to get political, so...
Oh, go ahead, I don't care. Ask me.
We want to use your real name, so I don't want you to say anything that would, you know...
Well, I'll just candy coat it, you know, if it's something real sensitive, because we live in very, very, very touchy times where a lot of people are looking for something. Go on about, you know, so you have to be very tactful with how you phrase everything.
Diplomatic.
Unless you're on the right side right now, you know, unless you're on the right side of
yeah
the paradigm at the moment, and then you can be as you know, fanatical and mean-spirited and hateful as you want.
For now, because of course it may be changing faster than people suspect.
It could change. You never know.
That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Karen McCoy. Part 2 will be up this Saturday, the 13th of October 2018. The observant listeners will have noticed that I have changed the order of the podcast from Saturday, Wednesdays to Wednesday, Saturday. For personal reasons, this fits better with my routine. Next week, there's a podcast with Jonathan Leatham, and after that I think with James Howard Kunstler. I've already talked with Jim for his podcast, so we've arranged a follow-up conversation for the Limitless. I will blog about this and other recent developments to make sure that you don't miss out. I encourage listeners to support this enterprise with donations or by buying my books, one of them at least. That's Prisoner Infinity, Seen and Not Seen, Paper Tiger, Dark Oasis. Vice of Kings is coming out at the end of this year. Also, if you're interested in a one-to-one with me, I'm offering that, as well as a course that's now open for signing up. Applied Liminality, it's called God's Lonely People. You'll find the information at the website in the consult tab. I think that's everything for now. Thanks for tuning in, so to speak, and participating in this project. This is Jason Horsley for the Liminalist at horticulture.com.